Can being aware of and changing your biases result in reducing financial risks? My guest today is Professor in Banking and Finance at the NUS Business School, David Reeb, and he's going to help us understand behavioral biases and the link between that and financial risk within the context of us here in Singapore. How are we doing? Professor Reeb will be speaking about this at a public lecture come Thursday. He's been featured in the Wall Street Journal, Business Week, The Economist, Forbes, Financial Times, among many other major news outlets. And we welcome him now to Money FM. How are you, Professor?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me here.
Thanks for joining us. I have to ask because, you know, I've been trying to get people interested in tuning into this segment by talking about Richard Thaler. Tell us what the distinction is between behavioral finance and behavioral economics.
Behavioral economics is concerned with a wide range of decisions. It can be anything from marriage to how the government should spend money to how companies should finance. So finance is a subset of economics. So I'm going to speak about only about the behavioral aspects that deal with the parts within finance, not going to be talking about marriage or raising children or those other aspects of economics and sociology.
Okay, but what is behavioral finance?
So the short answer is when we first start thinking about how to model the world or how to think about how people make decisions, we always thought that people were rational. Now, when I heard the term rational, I wasn't quite sure what it meant. So I finally realized I should get the picture in my head. There was a movie back in the 50s called The Forbidden Planet, and they had the character called Robbie the Robot. And Robbie the Robot would walk around and go, Mr. Rogers, and things like this. And he said things – he was always extremely logical. Everything was completely rational. It always made sense. It was always the right thing to do. And if he made an error, it was just because he didn't have the right data. And if he had the right data, he always made the right decision. That's how we model most things in finance. Unfortunately, people don't really work that way. We try to be rational, but we make mistakes all the time. And if those mistakes were random, it wouldn't be a problem, but those mistakes are actually systematic and come from the way we sort of make shortcuts in making decisions.
So biases is one of those mental shortcuts we make.
It is. So we can think about these as, like, for example, one that's very prominent in finance and affects a lot of financial decisions, something called familiarity bias.
Mm.
Okay. Now, familiarity bias is this notion that I just like things that are familiar to me, mm-hmm. right? So I grew up with this sports team, and so I prefer that sports team to other sports teams. There's no rhyme or reason for it, okay? It's just, this is the team that I like. Okay, it doesn't matter if I move someplace else. I'm familiar with that sports team, so I root for them. Okay, now, when we come to finance, where we think this can have a real problem is when we think about investing. So finance says, when we step back for it, and what we teach in like Finance 101 is you should hold a well-diversified portfolio. You shouldn't just buy one stock. You shouldn't buy two stocks. You should buy a multitude of stocks, and they should be from all over the place and all types of assets and all types of industries and all types of countries. But when we look at what people actually invest in, they don't really do that and intend to invest in a very few small number of things that are very familiar with them. So for example, within Singapore, if you look at the typical Singaporean portfolio, 39% of their investment is in Singapore. So that sounds okay. It sounds like they have a lot of foreign, right? But the problem is Singapore only makes up 0.4% of the world GDP. Hmm. So Singapore is small, so if you have 39%, it's concentrated in a very small area. So what you would really like, we would say from a theory standpoint, you should invest in the global portfolio and you should have a very small percentage in Singapore because it's 0.4% of the world economy. But instead, most people have 39% in Singapore in that economy, so they hold an undiversified portfolio. And we think that's because of they're just more familiar with Singapore, mm-hmm. and so they invest there, even though it's not really the right thing to do from a rational framework.
This is so fascinating because don't we think people make business decisions grounded in rationality and logic and profit motivation? But you're saying that there are psychological attributes. And just because we're aware of these biases, does it mean we can change them?
It's difficult to change them because the problem is sometimes we're not even aware of them. It's not a matter of like, well, I get more education and all of a sudden they go away.
It's like a blind spot, isn't it?
It is like a blind spot, and we can usually rationalize it in some way. Okay.
Can you give us another example of a bias?
I can give you lots of different examples of biases. That's the nice thing about it. There's all kinds of them, right? One of my favorite is overconfidence. Okay. So people are overconfident. not too surprising, right?
If you just investors or people in general?
Oh, just people in general. Just this is not this is just people in general are overconfident, right? If you ask them to rank how good of drivers they are.
Okay? Oh, yeah.
90% of the people think they're great drivers.
Yes.
My experience is that 90% are not great drivers, right? Okay. But how does that affect then like corporations then? So if you think about who managers who have risen up the ranks in a firm, so every year they get promoted and all of a sudden they're the CEO of the firm. This is a very confident person now, right, who's taken 15 years and risen their way through the ranks. They're going to be extremely confident. We're already all overconfident to begin with. So when we think about how this overconfidence bias might affect people, we would expect it to be especially problematic in firms where they have – shareholders who are outsiders, and the firm is run by professional managers. We would expect them to be extremely overconfident and make, say, aggressive acquisitions on average.
Wow, this is so fascinating. Are there gender differences in this overconfidence?
There are gender differences in this overconfidence.
Let's
hear
it.
I wonder why you asked that one. It is true the men tend to be much more overconfident. This isn't just by CEOs, though. You see this in investing behavior as well. So if you look at portfolios, in the rational framework, most of us should very seldom change our portfolio. We should buy some stocks and then we wait a while. When new information comes in, we change them. But, you know, new information doesn't really come in that often in terms of really changing the total portfolio allocation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what you observe is that men, on average, churn their portfolio a lot. Mm-hmm. They go in there and just play with it, right, because they think they're going to make money by doing this. The women are not doing that at all. They kind of look at that and go, yeah, I'm not that overconfident that I can beat the market today, so I'm just going to let sit it. I'm going to set it. It's going to be set right, I hope, and then I'm going to let it go for a while. So you definitely see some of these differences in males and females.
What does behavioral finance think of value investing?
Ah, behavioral finance thinks that value investing is really just a manifestation of behavior of recognizing behavioral finance. So when we think about what value investing says, it says, look, focus on firms where you understand the cash flows. That makes perfect sense. And shed or don't invest in firms that are based strictly on appreciation, where you don't really understand the business. Okay. Well, when we think about how some of these biases work and how they're going to affect asset purchases, where we expect some of the biggest problems from a bias entering into the decision is when I don't know much about the firm. And when I don't know much about the firm, it's usually because I can't follow their cash flows. So in areas where it's hard to trace the cash flows, in areas where it's difficult to really value it, that's where you're going to see the most bubbles and the most froth in the market. So value investing in one sense is just a way to think about avoiding some of these behavioral biases.
If we talk about reducing financial risk, which is perhaps among the most essential biases we should be aware of?
So I think I would apply it more to a problem. What are the problems that I think? So when we think about behavioral biases, as I said, you can think about them affecting the market, you can think about them affecting companies, and you can think about them affecting individuals. And where I think they're probably the biggest is within individuals. Behavioral biases in the markets, somewhat arbitrage can limit them to a certain extent. And in firms, we have governance devices. But within individuals, households, there's nothing to limit these behavioral biases hardly. And they're quite severe, unfortunately.
Mm.
So when we think about things like I mentioned a minute ago, they're investing, right, that people invest primarily in their home market. They also invest primarily in their own company. Right? Now, that sounds good at first. You know, I like my company. I'm really pro on my company. I should invest in my company.
Hmm.
The problem is it's another diversification problem. In an ideal world, I would not work for one company. I would work for 30 companies. Why? Because what if that company goes bankrupt? I don't want to get fired and get let go if the company goes bankrupt. So I'd really like to work every day of the month someplace different. I can't really do that. I have to work for one company. So my human capital is completely undiversified. So now to take my investment money and put it in that same company, if the company has a problem, not only do I lose my job, now I lose my savings as well.
Mm.
So this is a real problem. So you could think about like somebody who is at, you know, Nokia, right? If you were at Nokia, you probably weren't too enthused about having all your money invested in Nokia, right? So when we think about these at the individual level, we can really think about them having some severe problems.
Okay. So you say that it also affects problems at organizations like C-suite level decision making.
Absolutely. When we think about the C-suite, we need to think about it in terms of the context of the type of organization it is. Is it a family-controlled firm? Is it a firm that's state-controlled? Or is it a firm with just a widely dispersed ownership structure and say – so if you think about a firm like that, you can also think about like this concern of called status quo bias.
Mm.
Now, status quo bias
– preference for.
Exactly. Well, and the notion is, look, the company's going well. We don't want to disturb it. We don't want anything to be a problem. Our business is really good. And I'm worried that if I make a mistake, I'm going to get blamed for it. All right. And so when we think about status quo, we think about problems like Nokia again and BlackBerry were two firms that were really riding quite high. You know, we all used to have a Nokia phone, right? We had that brick and it was wonderful and I was so proud of it. And then the BlackBerry, I was like, oh, this is so awesome, right? And so those are companies that could have done what Apple did, could have done what Samsung did, and it did not. It wasn't like they hadn't thought about this. They just elected not to do it because they wanted to protect their current businesses. And this status quo bias is something that's quite acute within most C-suites. They're very concerned about damaging their current business, even if they know there's a better way to go forward, even if it would make sense to go forward, because if they try it and it doesn't work, they're going to get personally blamed, and that's a real problem for them.
How does behavioral finance deal with cross-cultural examples?
So,
does it find there's a difference? Does culture mitigate the biases?
I would say that where we focus on more is what type of cultural things and institutions amplify these particular biases. So when we think about, say, for example, savings of individuals. So if you live in a country that has, say, a big government subsidy or a big government retirement plan, okay, where you're going to – as soon as you retire, all your medical is paid for by the government. They pay for everything just about. Well, that's going to mitigate some of these behavioral biases to a certain extent. It may cause some other problems, but the behavioral biases and savings aren't as much of a problem anymore because the person is not responsible for it. So when we think about culture, we think about these institutions and we think about how they're going to mitigate and alleviate some of these potential problems more.
What does behavioral finance think of the whole area of cryptocurrency?
Ah, so in behavioral finance, one of the things – when you start from the traditional model in finance, kind of our starting point, there's no such thing as a bubble. Mm. Okay? They just can't exist because everyone's completely rational. Everyone has the information and bubbles should all immediately disappear because everyone will realize it's a bubble. Okay? Now, cryptocurrencies are kind of a unique case because in behavioral finance, we can think that bubbles can exist with no problem. The reason bubbles exist is there's an uptick in good information. Everybody goes, ooh, that thing's rising up. I like things that rise. Well, I should have been in on that thing. I wish I had been in on that thing. I should be in on that thing. Oh, I'm a smart person. I'm really overconfident and I'm optimistic about my own skill set. I'm going to ride the bubble right on up. And since I'm going to ride that bubble up, I'll know when to get out of the bubble. Okay? That's going to be my special skill. And so in behavioral finance, we tend to think of that bubbles – can arise, especially when it's something that's really difficult to value and people don't really know what it is. So when we think about cryptocurrencies, well, what is a cryptocurrency, right? It doesn't really matter which one you pick. You can pick any of them. So my first thought was, well, how should I think about valuing them, right? So is this like a stock or a bond? Is it going to pay me dividends or coupons in the future? No, it's not going to do that. So it's not like a stock or a bond. I got that pretty quick. How about the supply? Well, there's new ones coming in literally every few minutes. So the supply keeps growing. And not only on any given currency does it keep growing, but there's new currencies that come along. So the supply seems pretty infinite to me. Mm-hmm. Okay. How about the demand? I have no clue what the demand is. Okay. So I've got infinite supply. I don't know the demand. Now, is there any intrinsic value? Maybe it's like art. Okay, you know, like art doesn't generate cash flows. I like things that generate cash flows. I'm a finance professor. But art doesn't generate cash flows, but I like art. I like looking at art. Maybe I like staring at a Bitcoin, but it's digital. I don't think anybody's going to enjoy stealing that. Okay, maybe it's money. It's a new and better form of money. Okay, so we can think about that. Well, money has three things that it does. So one thing is it facilitates transactions. Well, currently the Singapore dollar does a pretty good job of facilitating transactions. I don't have any problem paying for anything with Singapore dollars anywhere. So I don't think that's a big immediate thing. a store of value. We want money to be a store of value, right? So the Singapore dollar is a very strong currency. It's very stable. I like keeping my wealth in Singapore dollars. Mm. How about cryptocurrencies? They bounce all over the place. I would cry if my savings went way down, okay? So I don't think it's a store of value. The other third thing we think money does is it facilitates lending in a crisis to banks. Well, there's no way that cryptocurrency can do this. So it's not money. It's not stocks. It's not bonds. It sounds a lot like tulips to me, you know, or something. The only thing I can even think of a demand for one of these currencies is for like illegal transactions. But other than that, it's hard for me to think of anything value for it.
Oh, boy.
So for me, when I think about it, it's hard for me to put a value on it.
Okay.
And when it's hard to put a value, that's when it's ripe for bubbles.
Okay. So I think behavioral finance is very clear on cryptocurrencies. Thank you so much to Professor David Reeb, holding the chair of the Mr. and Mrs. Lin Zhou Yan Professorship in Banking and Finance at NUS Business School. He will be delivering a public lecture on Thursday on mitigating financial risk. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Influence. I'm Michelle Martin. Stand by for the news.